and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business and esports. Today, we are focusing in on marketing pathways in the industry and what we can learn from legacy organisations and industries, and vice versa, how can we teach them to communicate to a new and differently engaged consumer base. I'm joined by Simon Bennett, the former partnerships director for Faceit and now founder of WeRC, a platform that is going to be assisting emerging esports titles in building up their ecosystems and their standing in the industry. Simon and I have been working together on a few bits and bobs over the last few months, and hopefully we're going to be starting off at the end of the year with a set of B2B invite-only events, probably late November, but watch this space for some more details. Simon, thank you very much for coming on.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
So just before we get started into the nitty-gritty of how marketing is done in esports and what we can learn from other industries, why don't you take us through your story, how you got to where you are today, and your story as a gamer.
Okay, yeah, sure. I've been in the industry now for quite some time, about coming up to sort of 14 years. I actually initially had absolutely no intention of being anything to do with marketing or gaming industry. I wanted to be a biology teacher. and I went through that pathway, kind of got pretty disillusioned by the whole system and how the UK works with the teaching industry. And I have so much respect for current teachers right now for that exact reason. And basically, I went through about 6 months of my life where I was totally clueless as to what I was doing. I moved back to my dad's house, and I felt like crap, basically. During all the way through that time, I picked up World of Warcraft, and I was playing tons of World of Warcraft with quite a high-level guild. Sort of doing, you know, going for the typical nerdy guild stuff of trying to get world firsts and things like that. And little did I know that a couple of our guild members were Blizzard GMs. And I, one day late in the evening, when I was lamenting at the fact that I wasn't able to get a job and that I wasn't really sure what I was doing with my life, they said, why don't you send a CV into Blizzard and see what comes from it. And obviously they helped push that through. And I got sort of my real start in the industry working for Blizzard as a games master, in World of Warcraft. And I quickly moved through the ranks in Blizzard, ended up helping them a lot with their esports side. I did a lot of education internally on StarCraft and StarCraft 1 to teach people about how these games influenced esports at such a high level. And then, I got headhunted from Blizzard to go to Wargaming to build their esports department from the ground up, which was very exciting. Then I left Wargaming and moved over to Razer for a couple of years and worked with Razer, which is a very exciting and fun team. I worked as a sponsor for Faceit. So I sponsored the Faceit Season 1 League. And I guess from that, I think I pretty much ripped them off and got a very cheap deal. and they liked that so much, I guess, that they hired me. Worked for Faceit for a couple of years. First of all, doing partnerships and marketing with them, and then moving across to their media side and running all the marketing and PR for Faceit on the media side. Recently, I've just left Faceit to start my own company, which is called We Are Seed, and we're a very B2B focused marketing company that deals with rapidly growing and marketing competitive communities with publishers specifically, and specifically on emerging game titles, so not the big names, but new esports titles. And we help with development of these types of games from a point of view where they are at the sort of design stages all the way up to games that are transitioning from free to play to from pay to play to free to play, or from alpha to beta, or that sort of thing. So that's what we're doing at the moment.
Awesome, man. It's always so fascinating for me to understand how people kind of fall arse backwards into this industry sometimes, because I did it exactly the same. You know, I was just sat at my desk as a researcher in my last organization, and then Walter Schleifer's just reached out to my old boss on LinkedIn, no message, no nothing, and I happened to be in a room when he said, "What the F is esports?" And at the time, I was a massive CSGO fan and of their team too, and I just spoke very fast and was very enthusiastic. I had to be told to calm down, and I basically managed to persuade one of our consultants to sit in on the call with us, and we won a piece of business, and it that was it. Now we're 3.5, maybe 4 years down the road. Incredible stuff, you know. It's just about being in the right place at the right time, I think.
Definitely, and I agree totally. I don't want to stray from the specific point of the day or anything, but I think I'm very passionate in helping people get their sort of start in the industry, and a lot of the sort of driving factors for me making my own company was to be able to give opportunities to especially young people and students as well, to help them to understand the how it is actually quite easy to get into this industry. You just have to be very, very hardworking and put yourself out there in the right places. There's plenty of work, but you have to be a bit humble and understand that you're going to start from the bottom.
Yeah.
You can't just walk in as sort of starting your own company and call yourself a CEO right at the beginning, because that's actually what's a bit damaging on the industry. It's always important to, you know, begin like in customer support like I did, or begin as an admin, a volunteer admin for one of the big third-party organizations that are always looking for people, or, you know, help out at an event, something like that. Like, there's so many opportunities out there. It just requires you to have that
that drive.
Yeah, that drive and that need to succeed, because there's a lot of people going for it too.
So let's take a step down into your experience, and let's chat about the industry. Marketing pathways in esports, how do they operate at the moment, and how have they changed over the last few years?
Where we are at the point of with marketing and gaming, and working with especially non-endemic people who are used to a very traditional marketing method, is that there's still a lot of bullshit. Sorry, pardon my French. within this industry, there's lots of numbers being thrown around that don't really make any sense, or are maybe inflated by using the right numbers in the wrong way, or the wrong numbers in the right way. I'm not sure how you want to talk about it, but it's very important to help non-endemics and traditional marketing people to sort of see through that and to be honest about where we are in the industry. When it comes to the like traditional marketing pathways, I call traditional pathways are the standard sort of trifecta, which is advertising on television and radio, advertising through mail lists and mail shots and databases, and web marketing, which is like buyouts and banners on websites.
Sure.
Basically, none of those work with our industry. Which is always a bit of a interesting topic to approach.
Yeah.
I had a chat with the guys from Universal a couple of months ago, and their budget was mostly spent on those things. And it was an interesting chat to speak to someone who was incredibly knowledgeable about marketing and knew that he wasn't really aware of how to work with gaming marketing. And to in a way save him quite a lot of money, because really show him that these traditional methods don't work. And I think most people know that the reason for that is that obviously radio and TV in almost every country except England, with radio, isn't something that young people, especially nerdy gamer type people, even have.
Yeah.
They don't tend to watch TV at all, or even own a TV in many cases. And except for the UK, they don't really listen to radio all that much. The UK is a bit weird in the sense that actually about 75% of children under the age of, I think it's under the age of 18, listen to the radio, which is very, very rare. And we actually had quite a lot of success promoting through the radio in the UK.
It's interesting.
Which is a strange anomaly. But if you tried to approach that into any other country in Europe, basically, that would have no effect whatsoever. And the other thing about traditional marketing is it's generally very expensive, whereas gaming marketing or marketing to modern young people, which is actually how I try and talk about it nowadays, is it's more about talking about people under the age of 21 and how they actually communicate with each other. It's all about influencer marketing, viral marketing, community and social media marketing, and marketing through events and things like that. And mostly it's focused around content. Written word is generally not that popular anymore unless you're talking about something like Reddit. But in general, content is really king right now. So either bespoke created content with a video team specifically around a product or a product that you're trying to sell, or working with a well-known influencer to help drive visibility around your brand.
Super interesting. So we've just basically just bagged on how every other industry is doing it. But what can we learn from how non-endemics are approaching a wider marketing operation at like a macro level? Because there's still, whilst the budgets are quite low in esports and whilst the exposure is in its own way quite hard to craft, there has to be something that we can learn from these more established industries, be it, you know, having realistic expectations on actually the negotiations table, or maybe something different. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I totally agree. I think we often will write off that sort of information, and I think that it's a very bad thing to do to cut out hundreds of years of previous marketing experience, especially if you look at sports, because sports obviously translates probably the best right now. And traditional sports marketing and sports brand development is incredibly powerful. And I think one of the biggest things that esports can learn from sort of a traditional marketing method is how to build your brand properly. I still think nowadays that's probably one of the weakest areas that people have in esports, that companies have. Obviously, there's a couple of success stories, you know, companies like Razer, which did an amazing job building that brand. Fnatic is a very good example as well of how to build a strong brand around your product.
Exactly.
And maybe Cloud9 to some extent as a team. But there's so much you can learn around studying how real, huge global brands have approached building their marketing strategies. I mean, a good example is like Nike, for example. There's actually a great article written by this guy called Zareem Islam, who talks about how Nike currently owns 48% of the American athletic footwear market. And it owns 96% of the baseball footwear market. And to get to a point like that, when you're looking at esports, we have hundreds of brands in the space trying to vie for that sort of spot. And if you look at how someone like Nike, another good example would be like, if you're looking at more underground brand is like Supreme, on how they've traditionally made that mixture of an original style of marketing, which is a traditional television advertising storytelling, combining it with the more modern style of marketing with social media and virality. And I think that storytelling is probably one of the areas where in the gaming industry and in esports specifically, we need to get better at.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're very good at telling a story around a particular player if that player naturally exudes charisma, as it were.
There's very few of those around, though, right? Just because of the stereotype of what a hardcore esports pro would have to be to really get to that point.
Yeah, I agree totally, and I think that. But I think if you look at sports, there's not too many sports personalities that I would say are naturally charismatic. They exhibit a lot of the same sort of points that an esports professional would. I don't really enjoy making the comparison of sports people and esports people from a physicality point of view, but a dedication point of view they're incredibly similar. They dedicate their entire lives often to one game or to perfecting and being the best at a particular thing, and that generally means that you don't socialize as much, you don't get as much time to sort of be with your family or be in the public eye until you become famous. And then once you become famous, all of this attention is thrown upon you. And a lot of teams still have a hard time sort of helping players adjust to that level of fame. But within the sports industry, a lot of the brands have picked that up, and that it's part of the marketing culture that the players are educated by Nike. If Nike picks up a particular player that they want to promote, that player is then given a lot of training, educated, yeah. a lot of work with professional PR companies to understand how to talk and put across a product. In our industry, that's quite rare. And that's something that I feel could be learned very heavily from the traditional industry.
Well, I guess one of the reasons why it's probably not as strong in esports as a whole is just because actually the maybe that gulf of knowledge and expectation between non-endemics and what they're actually looking to get out of a sponsorship and how that would actually work in the esports industry, maybe that gulf is something that's actually making a lot of these organizations more cautious in the first place. I see so many parallels to sport and esports. I know that a lot of people either love to speak about them or some don't, like yourself. But when I've spoken to agents that have managed sporting talent, music talent, actors, and also esports professionals more recently, all of them have said it's really not any different. Like, they're just relatively young people that have been thrown into the limelight, have a lot of pressure on their shoulders and are normally take it for granted, even even if they're like working very hard to be the best at their craft, the entire time in the spotlight is it takes time to kind of accept that and be more mature in those environments. Like, I'm a massive mixed martial arts and a boxing fan. I've mentioned that a few times on the podcast. And one of the most fascinating things for me is when I watch a really talented young fighter, you know, step into the UFC for the first time. There's lots of, you know, almost hyperactive energy. There's lots of, you know, ego and
bravado, right?
Yeah, they win especially. But when you see them get to like 5 or 10 fights, maybe they've lost a close fight on points or been knocked out or whatever. Like, they just settle down. And it looks quite liberating in a way to have that pressure and that comfort in that environment. And I just don't think esports has been around long enough in its current form for lots of players to really have that. And there's that. And the support staff around the teams, whilst has improved a lot over the last 3 years, there's still a lot more that can be done to optimize how they move forward. I mean, we were speaking to Weldon Green on one of the last episodes, and it was absolutely fascinating to hear his thoughts on the mindset of a pro, how you build up mindfulness and mental resilience in the long and short mm-hmm. term around these major events. It's pretty cool stuff. So we've got a long way to go, but it's just really, really interesting to draw those parallels and understand where we are and take stock of how much potential there is in this space and how much more we can do.
Yeah, I agree. And I think when we're seeing this move of in the last the last year or so of television and let's say linear TV taking a much bigger interest in esports, because obviously the biggest attractor is the fact that esports specifically gives you access to this very elusive demographic of people who are generally very highly intelligent, generally have a fairly good disposable income, either students or they've qualified from university quite highly and are moving into computer science type jobs. This is obviously very generalized.
Sure.
But that sort of mixture that we're starting to see, and again, from myself, the last project I worked with Face It was the Universal Open, which was with Psionics and Rocket League. Understanding how NBC Universal approaches communication and how they approach marketing that product out to their existing community was fascinating. Mm. And I think that there's so much we can learn, especially from linear TV, on the right ways to manage your time and the right tone to take when communicating to a larger audience. And with esports, we're very good at communicating to ourselves, which are the gamers, the hardcore gamers.
Yeah.
But even past the hardcore gamers, we're quite difficult or quite bad at communicating to just gamers, which are a very different demographic. And I think that one thing we also don't do enough that we can definitely take from Stranded Marketing is to create these archetypes around our industry. You can't just lump gamers into one archetype, right? There's all kinds of different archetypal gamers, from ages to sex to games they prefer to, you know, there's absolutely tons of different ways to speak to those people. And television really well knows their demographics and the varying different demographics, and they know exactly how to aim marketing to focus at those demographics. And we can learn a lot from that as well.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I know that you guys used to work with Jinx. I've worked with Jinx in the past. Basically, what Jinx TV do is they're a 24-hour esports gaming channel with a co-ownership by ITV and Sky, for people that don't know. And they've tried to make this play to get esports on TV and bring in a regular audience, either from the hardcore base or from more casual viewers that are just scrolling through looking for content. A lot of what I've found with those guys in terms of their limited amount of success that they've been able to have is they can't make their mind up between prioritizing TV or the online piece, and they end up kind of half-assing both, and then the content is just, because it just seems quite far behind what everyone else is doing. Like if you look at their YouTube account, like the views are very low, like the quality of the guests that they have on, and the overall content is actually pretty low as well. And the one great thing that they still do is the bridge, but I also feel like that would be much better as a podcast. Like if you just get everyone around, people aren't going to tune in and watch an esports chat show for an hour or so. That's really going to happen unless it's a random event.
I think they've made where I would say that they've made a mistake is lumping esports into one thing. It's very common for people to say esports. You don't say I like ball sports, for example, yeah. Or I'm a big fan. Well, to some extent, you do say I'm a big fan of racket sports, but I mean, it's you would say I like football or I like rugby or I like American football, that you can't lump those into one thing. And someone who likes football generally doesn't like rugby. You know, their passion is on one thing. And I think the biggest issue with the bridge in general is that you can't have a show that has, you know, 5 minutes of football, then 5 minutes of rugby, then 5 minutes of horse racing, then 5 minutes of swimming. You know, the demographic just have no idea what they're going to be watching. It's much better to do an hour show on each one of those things where the discussion is much more in depth and addresses that particular demographic. Than this one eclectic show that it's very difficult to be excited about, because you really only care, like, as soon as they start talking about Dota, I don't know anything about Dota, and I'm not that interested in Dota, to be honest. I think that I and many will just switch off.
Yeah, I bumped into a few of the people that were doing the Hearthstone piece on there when I was at DreamHack Summer. I bumped into a few of the guests that are on there, and I immediately knew that whenever they started talking about Hearthstone, because they're so passionate about it, and because they have such a specific amount of knowledge, when they're kind of talking in breezy terms about this guy versus this guy at this tournament and using like a certain deck, like all of that strategy and tactics means absolutely nothing, which is actually a lesson that we can take for the future of esports titles too, in terms of actually being able to translate those into the mainstream. The MOBAs are propped up by massive player bases, and they're their own ecosystems in their own right, but the ultimate aim, I feel like, for esports is to get a much wider audience in, and it's only going to be through titles like PUBG that you and I will be playing later, which I'm really excited about, and a few others that are really simple to understand, hard to master, lots of depth, not as much RNG that's actually involved, but, you know, very focused, and very, very entertaining to watch. You know, I get so much out of watching Shroud and a few other CSGO pros, or just other personalities in the space that just, they jump on and play a squad, because it's organic and it's super entertaining too.
I like that you're passionate about it. I think, like, yeah, if we want to delve into game design, that I think that's a whole different discussion. But and something that I do love to talk about, so I will avoid that. But I think, like, from the point of view of, you brought up someone like Shroud, which I think is sort of, we can steer it back on course from that, is that gamers and esports fans being a sort of different monsters within each group, have different pathways of which they communicate with one another and of where they are influenced. Mm. And I think that you made a very good point in saying that you like to watch Shroud. And the reason I'm assuming you like to watch Shroud is because you can learn a lot from him.
Like, all of the crouch jumping through windows and all of this insane stuff where he's just in the school in the middle of the map and ends up like slaying about 10 people. I'm like, I can't hit my first shot most of the time, you know? It's just a nightmare. Yeah.
And I think that's a big definition between that and, because as you were an esports fan and a gaming fan who would probably watch Shroud and not really grasp the nuances of how good or bad he is compared to, and because they don't have that, they don't want to become better at a game, they just like a game. Mm. And I think that's, if you're talking about marketing to the gaming audience or to young people, you have to really clearly understand your own goal as a company, and you have to understand the type of demographic you want to aim at.
Yeah, it's when I've been speaking to a few football teams as well. Like I was at the iSport Connects conference a few months ago. I'm actually going to be at Leaders in Sport next week. If anyone who's listening is going to be there, just please hit me up on LinkedIn or an email. But we were speaking. Well, I was listening to a panel that were doing an overarching esports state of the nation piece, and there were some really interesting questions that were starting to come up from, say, the commercial director of a Premier League club, and they're like, so do we have to run our own events? And they were seeming to be focusing in only on that, and they weren't really looking at the wider opportunity. But then again, if you're looking at how venues are being used, not just in sport, but also, you know, like the whole cinema space is going all multi-use these days. So it's not just film, it's live production, it's sport, it's video gaming too. And if you have a massive stadium or a space where it's only going to be full during a certain season, there's no point in leaving that investment empty just for the sake of it. And I think that's where esports plugs in the midterm. If an organization doesn't already have an esports player, or say if they've just, you know, done like West Ham and Man City have done, which is just get an esports pro in for FIFA and use it for the PR, you know. So there's much more integrated ways to actually utilize all of these investments and actually bring in new people to your space, you know. I got one more question for you. For the last two episodes, I've been calling this dream job, which is really imaginative. So I've gone for something different this week. I'm going to call it Turning Back the Clock. Simon, if you could turn back the clock and have any pro-facing role in esports, so being a player, a manager, we had a mascot last week, of any esports title, fantasy, past, present or future, what would it be and why?
Yeah, this is the hardest question that you sent me to think about realistically. I think like logically mascots probably
I was really impressed by that last week by Brian, actually, yeah. Games.
I mean, honestly, the only thing I could think of, and I don't even know if this counts as pro facing, is I'd love to be like a professional observer. Okay. I think that's actually a really, really cool job. I unfortunately think the observers are never really given enough credit for what they do. I mean, they're the in-game cameramen of a video game, and I love, I'm very passionate in looking at new technology and how it can apply to esports, and I'm very excited about augmented reality And how AR games can sort of blur the line between video games and real sports. So I'd love to observe in a sort of the first big AR esports stroke sports game, as sort of the main producer cameraman for
that. Awesome. That's a great answer. I'm still waiting for someone just to say, I would be an entry fragger for CSGO, and then just leave it at that. Everyone's coming up with these really interesting answers. It's actually quite cool. It's like an extra layer behind all of the expertise. It's interesting.
I think when you talk to people who have always been on the business side of things, I guess, we've never really, like, I've never had an aspiration to become a pro player ever. It doesn't interest me. I love being a fan of esports, but I'm very excited about how the game is designed and how they've been, you know, that's the sort of stuff I get really hyped about, and talking to my friends about, oh, do you see what they did on that production? Do you see how the branding was done properly? And, you know, the lower third was so catchy. Yeah. That sort of thing is stuff that gets me really hyped. So I don't think like, oh, I wish I was that guy. I think like, I wish I'd thought of that way of marketing this. And I think that is maybe why you don't always get that answer.
The answers that we have been getting have been way, way better than I expected. So it's something that we'll keep doing. Dude, we have run out of time. So thank you very much for coming on the show. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch?
Best to do is to find me on LinkedIn. I seem to have a pretty strong LinkedIn game for some reason. I don't know how that worked. You can just search for Simon Bennett. Or We Are Seed as the company. Our website is seed.gg. Nice and simple. It's still under construction though, so I'd rather you just find me on LinkedIn if you want to chat.
Thank you very much for coming on. If you want to reach us, it's www.lookingforgroup.lfg.com or find us on LinkedIn at Joe Hills. Guys, thank you very much for listening. We've got so many awesome episodes for you over the next few weeks, so I'm really looking forward to getting those done for you. Speak to you soon.